Chapter 4. The next morning, Dobbs retold this story to Curtin while they were sitting on the plaza. Curtin listened eagerly to the yarn. When Dobbs had finished, Curtin said,
"I figure this story is a true one."
"Well, of course it's true," Dobbs maintained. "What made you think it might be a weak magazine tale?" He was surprised that anybody could doubt the truthfulness of the story, which Dobbs thought the prettiest he had ever heard. Yet Curtin's question, with that glimpse of doubt, had a strange effect upon the mind of Dobbs. Last night, when Howard had told the story in his slow, convincing tone, Dobbs had felt that he himself was living the story. He could not detect any fault in it. Everything had seemed as clear and simple as if it had been the story of a man who had made good in the shoe business. But the slight doubt of Curtin had raised the apparently plain story to that of high adventure. Dobbs had never before in his life thought that prospecting for gold necessarily must carry some sort of mystery with it. Prospecting for gold was only another way of looking for a job or working. There was no more mystery about it than about digging out a tank on a cattle ranch or working in a sand mine.
"I haven't said that the story's not true."
Curtin defended his opinion.
"There are a million such stories. Open any magazine and you'll find them. But even if part of the story sounds like fiction, there is one incident in the old man's story which is true as sunlight. It's that incident where the three partners, having spotted the mine, try to hold out on the rest."
"You said it." Dobbs nodded. "Well, that's exactly what I say. It is that eternal curse on gold which changes the soul of man in a second." The moment he had said this, he knew he had said something that never had been in his mind before. Never before had he had the idea that there was a curse connected with gold. Now he had the feeling that not he himself, but something inside him, the existence of which until now he had no knowledge of, had spoken for him, using his voice. For a while, he was rather uneasy, feeling that inside his mind there was a second person whom he had seen or heard for the first time.
"Curse upon gold?"
Curtin seemed entirely unmoved by this suggestion.
"I don't see any curse on gold. Where is it? Old women's tattle. Nothing to it. There is as much blessing on gold as there is curse. It depends on who holds it. I mean the gold. In the end, the good or the bad character of its owner determines whether gold is blessed or cursed. Give a scoundrel a bag with little stones or a bag with silver coins, and he'll use either to satisfy his criminal desires if he's left free to do as he pleases. And by the way, what most people never know is the fact that gold in itself is not needed at all. Suppose I could make people believe that I have mountains of gold. Then I could arrive at the same end as if I really had that gold. It isn't the gold that changes man. It's the power which gold gives to man that changes the soul of man. This power, though, is only imaginary. If not recognized by other men, it does not exist."
Dobbs, only half listening to what Curtin was saying, leaned back on the bench and looked up at the roofs of houses where men were at work putting up telephone wires. He had watched them the day before, and he watched them now, waiting for something to happen to them. They were standing there so unprotected that he wondered how they could work at all. "And all this," he said, "all this for 4 pesos and 50 centavos a day, with the possibility of dropping off and breaking their necks. A working man's life is a dog's life, that's what it is. Ah, hell, let's talk about something more amusing. Getting back once more to that story, I wonder, would you betray your pals just to have all the gold for yourself?" Curtin did not answer right away.
"I don't think that anyone can say what he would do if he had the chance to get all the cuts for himself just by a little trick or a bit of cheating. I'm sure that every man has acted differently from the way he thought he would when face to face with a heap of money or with the opportunity to pocket a quarter of a million with only the move of one hand."
"I think I would do as Harry Tilton did," Dobbs said. "That is the safe thing. Then one wouldn't have to sweat for others and run around hungry all the time. I sure would be satisfied with a certain sum. Take it and go away and settle down in a pretty little town and let the others quarrel." Returning to town in the afternoon after a swim in the river and a walk of 3 miles back to the city along a dusty road to save the 15 centavos streetcar fare, the two men began to talk about prospecting again. It was not exactly the gold alone they desired. They were tired of hanging around waiting for a new job to turn up, and of chasing contractors and being forced to smile at them and laugh at their jokes to keep them friendly. A change was what they wanted most. This running after jobs could not go on forever. There must be some way out of this crazy go-round. It was so silly to stand by the windows of the banking company and block the way of everybody who looked as if he might give you a job somewhere out in the fields. Half a week went by without even the smell of a job. It looked more than ever as if the whole oil business were going to die, at least in the Republic here, and for sure in this section of the country. By the end of the week, Dobbs felt that for the next 3 months there was practically no chance of any paying job. Many companies were beginning to close up a great number of fields, and others were making preparations to withdraw from the Republic altogether. Men who had worked steadily during the last 5 years were coming back to town and crowding the jobless. Dobbs, in a fit of desperation, said, "Everything is dying now. A lot of the boys who've got the money to pay for the tickets are making off for Venezuela, where a boom seems to be on its way. So everything is at an end here now for sure. Tell you, buddy, I'm making off now for gold even if I have to go all by myself. I'm sick of this town and of this life. If I have to eat the dust, I may just as well do it among the Indians in the Sierra Madre as in this dying town. That's what I think and what I mean."
"You said it, brother,"
Curtin admitted.
"And as for me, you may count me in. I'm ready even for stealing horses or cattle rustling."
"That's what I like to hear. What chances are you expecting to have after, let's say, 4 weeks?" Dobbs asked.
"Pocket picking in the Islas Marias."
"Islas Marias? Are there new oil fields?"
"No, you sap. Dobbs put him right. That's the penal colony where you will go if the pocket picking goes wrong and somebody grabs you firmly by your wrist. It isn't just a vacation to be on those islands, if you ask me. Do you know why the pictures of the Holy Virgin you see here in all the churches show a knife stabbed into her breast? That knife has been thrust into the heart of the Virgin by someone who had come back alive from the Maria Islands. There are very few guards on these islands, but you can't escape by swimming or going off in a small canoe, because they are guarded by 500,000 ferocious man-sharks."
"Pretty place, I have to say."
Curtin laughed.
"And so, pickpocketing and the like are out. Who wants to be guarded by sharks?"
"That's what I said. So I think we shuffle off tomorrow. The sooner we leave, the better. In this town, we spend our money for nothing. When we're on our way, we're actually investing our money. I'll talk it over tonight with old man Howard."
"With him?"
asked Curtin.
"What for? You don't mean to take him along. He's too old. We might have to carry him on our back."
Dobbs didn't agree. "Now, don't you make a mistake about that old man. He may prove tougher than both of us put together. Those old guys are like good old leather, more often than not. Besides, there's another point to think of. To tell the truth, I don't know much about prospecting. Frankly, I don't know anything of what gold looks like in the sand. It may lie there right in front of you, and you won't know it. You may think it's only another sort of rock or dust or clay or what have you. Then what? All your hard work and sweat is no good if you can't make out what is the real stuff and what is plain dirt. He's an old-timer at that job. He sure knows gold when he sees it, and he knows how to lift it. That's what we need. I tell you, we must have him. An experienced guy like him. Question is, will he go out with us puppies? Fact is, we should congratulate ourselves if he does."
"I never thought of it that way. I guess you're right. Let's ask him right now."
Curtin no longer had any objections. On coming to the Oso Negro, they found Howard lying on his cot, reading about bandits in a pulp.
"Me?"
He was right afire.
"Me? What a question. Course I'm going. Any time, any day. I was only waiting for one or two guys to go with me. Out for gold? Always at your service. I'd take the risk and make the investment. Let's see, how much do we have?"
He took a pencil and began scribbling on blank spaces of a newspaper ad.
"Well, I got $300 ready cash here in the bank. 200 of them I'm all set to invest. That's the last money I have in the world. After this is gone, I'm finished up. Anyway, if you don't take a risk, you can't make a win."
Curtin and Dobbs also began to go over their property, which consisted of what was left from the wages made under Pat's contract. It didn't amount to very much. All their money put together did not come up to what the old man meant to invest.
"Well, I'm afraid this won't go a long way."
Howard had made a list of the most essential provisions and tools needed, and he saw that even these modest expenses could not well be met with the money they had. Dobbs took a deep breath. He remembered his lottery ticket.
"Don't you get superstitious,"
Curtin warned him.
"I've never yet seen a person who won anything worthwhile in a lottery."
"It won't cost me anything to look at the list, will it?" Dobbs rose from his cot. Curtin laughed heartily.
"I'm going with you, Dobby. I wouldn't miss seeing your long face when you look for your number and don't find even the last figure of your ticket that assures you'll get your money back. All right, let's go and have the free circus.
There were lists everywhere. They were hanging in front of every sweet shop and cigar counter to make it as easy as possible for people to examine them. Most of the lists were printed on white cotton goods because they were examined so frequently and so nervously that those printed on paper did not last long, and they had to last for a year, since premiums were payable any time inside of 12 months after the drawing. At the tobacco stand outside of the Bristol Hotel, there hung a list.
"Just came in, the list, caballeros,"
said the girl in charge of the stand. "And what now, hey? What about superstitions now, you sap?" Dobbs patted the list in a caressing way. "That's the sugar Papa likes. Just look at this fat, rich, printed number smiling at you. That's my number. That's what it is. Know how much it means in cold cash for my 20th? 100 pesos. A full 100. Welcome, sweet little smackers."
"All right, you win. But this is an exception, and only the dumbs ever win. That's my idea."
"Your idea, all right." Dobbs felt superior with his 100 pesos easy money. "Maybe it's the dumbs that make the money. Doesn't matter. Point is to have the dough. And besides, you have to have a good hand to buy the right ticket, see?" "How does a dumb head know which is the winning number and which not? Tell me that. I picked the right number, didn't I?" Meanwhile, they had come to the agency where the tickets were paid. The ticket was carefully examined because smart fellows could change the printed numbers of tickets so well that even experienced tellers were, at times, deceived. But the ticket was okayed, and Dobbs received his money.
"Now it's my turn again to get 100 to make our investment as even as can be."
Curtin was trying to think of a way to get some money. At this moment, boys were running along the street with bundles of paper under their arms.
"San Antonio Express! The Express! The Express a Cabra de Iligar! Just arrived by train!"
They were yelling. One stopped in front of Dobbs and Curtin and offered the paper. Curtin bought it. Hardly had he glanced at the front page when he said,
"Here's the solution. That guy here. See his name? He owes me $100, and I see he's now in the big money. He bought a corner at Commerce Street. I'll wire him. He's a square shooter. He'll ship the dough."
So they went to the Western Union cable office, and with a few words, Curtin told the old pal of his plight. The same night, the pal from San Antonio cabled him $200 instead of the borrowed 100.
"Didn't I tell you he's on the level, that old pal of mine over in good old S.A.? That's what you may call a friend in need."
Curtin felt not less superior now than Dobbs had felt in cashing his lottery ticket in the morning.
"We better not wait long,"
Howard suggested.
"Let's take off tomorrow."
They agreed. Next day, they took the night train to San Luis Potosi, where they boarded the train for Aguas Calientes to reach the main line going north. 4 days later, they were in Durango. Here they occupied themselves for 2 days studying maps and trying to get information from all sorts of people who knew this part of the Republic.
"Now look here, you puppies,"
Howard explained.
"Where you see a railroad, there's no use going there. There aren't any motor roads, so let's forget about these roads. Don't even look near dirt roads. Wherever there's a railroad or any other road, there's no use going close, because railroad constructors and road builders usually examine every bit of soil near the roads while they're building them. That's only natural, and it's part of their business. So it'd be a waste of time to look for anything around places where engineers have been at work."
"I think I see what you're driving at." Dobbs began to understand Howard's plans.
"Not so difficult to see, boys, after I've made it clear what is virgin soil and what isn't."
Howard went with a pencil over the map he had spread out before him.
"We have to go where there's no trail. We have to go where we can be positive that no surveyor or anybody who knows something about mining has ever been before. The best spots are those where you feel sure that anybody who's paid for his job would be afraid to go and would not think it worthwhile to risk his hide for the salary he gets. Only at such spots is there a chance that we might find something. These are the regions we have to make out on this map."
He drew a few lines over small sections of the map, made a few dots here and a few dots there. For a while, he looked at these vague sketches, seemingly weighing one against the other. Then, with a definite gesture, he made a little circle on the map at a certain point.
"Here's where we're bound, hereabouts."
He thickened the little ring with his pencil.
The exact site doesn't matter very much, not in detail, so to say. Let's see the spot at close range and then decide what to do. Here on this map, we can't make out properly whether it's mountain, swamp, desert, or what. But that shows that the makers of the map themselves don't know for sure what there is. Once on that spot, all you have to do is wipe your eyes and look carefully around you. I once knew a feller who, believe it or not, could smell gold if it was close, just as an ass will smell water if he's thirsty and wants to drink. And this reminds me, boys, we'll have to go out to a few villages nearby to buy burros, which we need for carrying our packs and for other services at the camp.
So they spent the next 3 days buying burros from the Indian peasants.